This week on Texas Scorecard Radio, in the news, a prosecutor declines to go after House Speaker Dennis Bonin. We'll also hear about how citizens are fighting back against the city of Austin's crazy homeless camping policy. In our interview, we're joined by Jeremy Newman, who breaks down three big cases moving through the Texas courts that are very significant to your rights as a parent. And we'll close with an autopsy report from Kerry Cheshire, explaining what happened with spending limits legislation this session. Welcome to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas. You can find us on the web at www.texasscorecard.com. I want to get started with this week's top news. We've got Brandon Waltons, Capital Bureau Chief for Texas Scorecard. Brandon, you and I were talking last week. Disgraced Texas House Speaker Dennis Bonin announcing his retirement from the legislature, but we weren't sure what the situation was with whether he would face criminal prosecution. We now have some more clarity on that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so after this months-long saga that ended with Speaker Dennis Bonin saying that he's not going to run for re-election after an audio recording was released of a backroom meeting he had where he was offering a quid pro quo offer to Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan for media credentials in exchange for the targeting of certain Republican legislators in his chamber. Well, after this whole saga seems to be coming to an end, it looks like not going to be any prosecution, at least from his home county of Brazoria, Brazoria County, into this situation.
Yeah, so Brazoria County DA Jerry Yenny coming out with a statement, not very flattering statement, but saying, I'm not going to prosecute him.
No, exactly right. I mean, she says in the statement, I'm looking at it right now, says the behavior and statements were offensive. They lacked character and integrity. They were demeaning to other human beings, kind of going on and on. But says at the end of this letter, in this big kind of letter she puts out to the media, says ultimately not going to prosecute here, despite receiving, and this is after, by the way, an investigation by the Texas Rangers where they looked into the audio. She says they said, you know, scientifically accurate, it's everything's there. So a very, very interesting development, one that I guess maybe a small victory for Bonin there.
Yeah, a lot of speculation from people based on the language of the letter that there may have been some kind of agreement. Hey, if you will, you know, retire from the legislature, not run for re-election as speaker, then we won't prosecute you. A lot of people speculating, but of course that's speculation.
A lot of speculation. The DA there says that no such deal was made, but you know, one of those things that you know we may never know, right?
Sure.
If something like that.
And not completely out of the woods yet, because this is one decision by the local DA, but obviously you've heard nothing from whether maybe federal prosecutors might get involved in this.
That's right. You could have the FBI getting involved. There's a number of other avenues to which there could be some criminal charges against him. But regardless of whether or not that happens, I mean, the big takeaway here is that, you know, for Speaker Bonin, I mean, his political future is all but finished at this point, right? He's not returning to reelection. He's not going to return as Speaker. And I think he'll have a hard time in the future.
Thanks for that, Brandon. Now let's turn and talk to Jacob Asmussen with the Central Texas Bureau. Jacob, you and I have been talking on the program a lot about this homeless camping ordinance that's gone over very poorly in Austin. The city council basically allowing the homeless to run rampant through downtown. Now citizens there in Austin and Travis County figuring out ways to fight back.
That's true, Tony. Austinites are pretty angry at their city council. Recently, a new political action committee was formed by a group of citizens called Our Town Austin, and their goal is this. They are trying to kick out Austin's mayor and five of the city council members.
Yeah, and so tell folks a little bit. I obviously mentioned this homeless camping ordinance. It's really been pretty devastating to the image of the city, the livability of the city. I mean, it's a really bad deal. The governor has even weighed in saying he might get involved. It's not a good policy.
Absolutely, Tony. The Political Action Committee stemmed from a city council decision in June, like you mentioned, that allowed homeless people to camp across the city in public spaces. And it got national backlash, like you said, from the governor, from U.S. Rep. Chip Roy, the Austin police chief, the University of Texas police chief, all wrote open letters to Austin's mayor saying, you need to reverse this. This is causing a serious public safety risk. And this needs to stop.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've actually seen almost a uniting of even, you know, Democrat voters, Republicans, you know, anybody who's kind of a normal voter is looking at this saying, hey, why aren't you listening to us? And it seems like, you know, they're really listening to homeless advocate activists who are trying to push an agenda on that front and that resonating. So let's talk a little bit about this effort. It's a recall effort to try and pull these guys off the council, I guess, under the city charter, they're able to do this recall effort.
Right. So they have to get, the PAC has to get 10% of petition signatures from the entire city to recall the mayor. And then they've got to get 10% of the population from each council member's district to recall each member. And I think what sums it up really well, Tony, is the PAC's treasurer, Sharon Blythe, said, quote, I have witnessed the city council over a number of years not paying attention to the taxpayers of Austin, not having transparency in their decisions, and not listening to the citizens. As she said, we are a citywide organization that is fed up with the city council and the way they are voting. So that kind of sums up the sentiment of how Austinites are feeling right now, and now they are doing something about it.
Yeah, well, it'll be really interesting to see, you know, it's encouraging to see people stand up and not just put up with bad policy, but actually take action. This is a great tangible step to take action, to take back their city council, take back their city government, and make sure that it's responsive to the people as opposed to the activists. Thanks for your reporting on it, Jacob.
Thanks, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to welcome back on the program Jeremy Newman with Texas Homeschool Coalition. A lot of listeners who frequently listen to the show know Texas Homeschool Coalition, not just about the issue of homeschooling, but really, truly the leading parental rights organization in Texas, fighting battles for the rights of parents. And Jeremy, I wanted to have you on because Texas, we're seeing Texas become a battleground, a hotbed of cases involving parental rights.
Hey, Tony. Yeah, it's great to be back on. And yeah, you're definitely right. There have kind of been three major cases in the news and in the courts for the last few months, this year in particular, that have kind of captured attention on the parental rights issue. And ironically, actually, all of them had legislation presented in 2019 that would have addressed those issues.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Obviously, we're having these battles in the courts, and I think ultimately, and we'll talk a little bit about this, because the legislators have failed to do things that they could have done to solve these problems. But let's start first with this Younger case that's been in the news. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there and the developments. I think listeners will be a little familiar, but give them a little primer and where we're at on developments in that case.
Yeah, so the basic issue in the Younger case was you have a mother and father who are divorced or had their marriage annulled, and there's a custody dispute going on over these two twin boys. And the part that's really hit the news is that James, one of those two twin boys, the dispute over him is whether he's a boy or a girl. And the mother's coming in arguing that, you know, even though he's a biological boy, that he should be transitioned to a girl. He identifies as a girl, and he's 7 years old. So keep this in mind. And this battle's been going on since he was, I think, three or four. And the father's coming and saying, look, he only seems to be interested in being a girl when he's with mom for some reason. And when he's here at my house, he's happy being a boy. He wants to be a boy. He acts like a boy. And so it's not just a dispute about what to call him, you know, whether he's to call him a boy or a girl, there's a legal dispute about who has the right to make medical decisions for him going forward. You know, is he going to be given puberty blockers? Is he going to be, you know, medically transitioned at some point? And so that's really what the big dispute has been about, that kind of captured national attention.
Well, and initially, it seemed you had this ruling where you had a very liberal Dallas County District Court judge and kind of these institutions there taking the side of the mother and saying, hey, absolutely, let's get him into treatments that, you know, whether immediately or down the road would result in irreversible physical damage to the child. And on the other side, you had, you know, the father and all these people saying, this is child abuse, what's going on here. And you saw a little bit of a reaction, a jumping in by leaders to say, okay, we've got to do something to stop this.
Right. Yeah. So what was going on is that the parents had joint custody of both kids, but the mother was the one who had the right to make medical decisions for the kids. And so the concern that kind of blew this up was that the mother was, openly looking into medical and potentially down the road, even surgical treatments for James to transition him from a boy into a girl. And the father was powerless to stop her. And so they were going to court having this custody dispute, and the father filed this motion asking for sole custody of James so that he would be able to make these decisions. And that's what put this, you know, this transgender issue kind of in the spotlight. And so the jury came back on that and said, hey, look, we're not going to give the father sole custody of James. And that basically left the whole thing at the status quo level, meaning that the mother was going to maintain the right to make all the medical decisions. But then several days later, the judge weighed in the case and modified the orders to say, hey, look, you're both going to maintain joint custody, but also you're going to both have joint power over medical decisions. So that was kind of the big win that I think a lot of people didn't understand how exactly that happened. The big win was that now the father has a say in medical decisions.
Yeah, and so obviously she can't be doing things that are radically invasive and destructive to the child without, you know, his consent to it. So that's an achievement, and I think that is a result of the outcry that you're seeing. Obviously, you had Governor Abbott make certain statements about the case. You had, I think you were explaining, Attorney General Paxton came in with a letter at a certain point there. They're saying, you know, hey, this is nuts.
Yeah. And, you know, the irony here is I believe earlier in the case that the mother actually filed a motion to have the father's rights terminated on the theory that he was abusing James by not affirming his identity as a girl. Right. And so the attorney general weighed in and told the, you know, CPS to investigate this mother because she's openly telling people that she's going to be investigating, you know, puberty blockers and possibly even surgical treatments down the road for this child, and they're unnecessary and harmful is the point. And you have, you know, this is the transgender issue is traditionally kind of a left-right issue, but it's interesting that when this hit the news, you had people across the political spectrum. In fact, I was telling you earlier that, you know, Blair White, who's a transgender YouTuber, came out saying, look, guys, this is child abuse. This child is 7 years old. They can't make this decision for themselves. And, we're talking about making potentially irreversible decisions for this child before they understand the consequences of it.
Yeah, so even transgender activists, some of them acknowledging that this is crazy. This actually transition is the taking the child away. The Pardo case, big developments there. You and I talked about this a while back, but a case where, you know, a lot of people were out there looking at this younger case saying, oh, well, is there anything that we can do? And they're going, well, just throw our hands up, can't do anything. But at the same time, you actually have CPS doing very aggressive things and wrong things to go after the Pardo family, and seeing y'all are winning some victories on that issue. So tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, so that's exciting. So last Thursday, the Texas Supreme Court weighed in and they issued what's effectively a temporary order telling the lower court, hey, send Drake home immediately. And the reasoning they gave was they said that CPS failed to prove that there was a continuing danger that justified removing Drake from his home. And for the audience's sake, if anyone's not familiar with it, the basic issue in the case was that CPS snatched Drake's four-year-old child from his parents after a doctor who had been fired by the family for refusing to visit Drake reported them to CPS. And it's kind of caught in the national spotlight because once CPS realized they made a mistake, they didn't admit error and send Drake home. They just dug in their heels, and it's perpetuated over about 4 months now.
Yeah, and so this child is separated from the family for months because of institutional inertia, bureaucrats substituting their medical judgment for the judgment of the parents. It's honestly similar to what's going on in the younger case where you have these left-wing institutions taking the side of the mother, and you have the father trying to connect with people and bring awareness to the case so that there can be some common sense and decency. Interesting, you mentioned the letter from Attorney General Paxton. These two cases, there was this tie between these two cases.
Yeah, so this was really interesting. So the Attorney General weighed in and asked CPS to investigate the mother in the James Younger case for child abuse based on her saying that she's going to be giving unnecessary medical treatment. Now, the interesting thing is that's the exact same accusation CPS was making in the Pardo case. They claimed that the family was giving unnecessary medical treatment. And in the letter, the Attorney General tied these two things together and basically said that CPS was being hypocritical because they snatched this family, and that's their word, they snatched this family from, or this child, Drake, from the Pardo family in Dallas and seemed to not give it a second thought. But then over here in the James Younger case, they were aware of it and have been for a while and let it happen.
Yeah, and we're refusing to act because everybody's familiar that bureaucracy is always left-leaning typically, and so this is the left-wing zeitgeist of the day is right. We're going to play mad scientist with children's gender, and so this is something that's tolerated. There's another case that's going on in the Supreme Court, not getting the same level of attention, but is equally important from a parental rights standpoint. Tell us about the Clay case.
Yeah, so in the Clay case, it hasn't hit the news like the other two have, but the legal implications of it are really significant. So effectively what's going on there is that you had a mother and a father who were divorced and they had 50-50 custody of their four-year-old daughter. And the mother died in a car accident, but 11 months before she died, she started living in the same home with her boyfriend. And so by the time she died, this boyfriend had spent about 6 months of that 50-50 time living with this four-year-old girl. In Texas, 6 months is all you need to qualify to be able to file for custody of the child. And so when the mother died, this four-year-old girl went straight back to the father by default, but then this boyfriend filed for custody of the four-year-old girl against the biological father. And what's interesting is the mother and father-in-law in the case also filed for custody. They were both denied custody because the court said they were unable to overcome the presumption that the biological father should have custody. But the non-relative and relatively a virtual stranger to the child was able to get custody, including overnight visits and partial medical decision-making power. And the reason that they said was because they said, well, this non-relative comes to the court on equal footing with this biological father, even though the actual relatives to the child had to overcome a high legal presumption and were unable to do it.
Yeah, because this guy had been living with the child through the relationship with the now deceased mother, he's on equal footing with a biological father, is what
exactly.
They're saying.
Exactly.
And yeah, so I guess basically there's a constitutional question involved.
Yes, exactly that. And the kind of one of the reasons this came about is because last year the Texas Supreme Court put out a decision that said, hey, that 6 months you have to be able to file for custody. Well, by the way, it doesn't have to be exclusive. It doesn't have to be consecutive. So what that means is that, you could have any number of people, if they were all living in the house at the same time, qualify to be able to file for custody of a daughter just because they lived with the daughter, not because they were taking care of the daughter. And so that's what happened here, is that this boyfriend, even though the mother was living in the house there, was actually the one taking care of the daughter, qualified to file for custody just because he lived in the same household. and he received it. And it went to the Texas Supreme Court, and we filed a brief defending the father. The Texas Public Policy Foundation filed a brief defending the father, and the court issued a temporary order in that case as well, and put a halt on the grant of custody to the non-parent. And we're waiting, until full briefing is finished in the beginning of December to actually see what their opinion is. But my thought here is that they're going to go straight to the constitutional issue, because the constitutional case law here is really clear. It says, hey, look, the parent of the child has a right to raise their child. And you have to assume that the child, whatever decision the parent is making is in the best interest of the child. So
And we would hope, basically we would hope that the court would come in and give a constitutional ruling to say, okay, yeah, common sense and our common principles is that we're going to protect the rights of parents, of actual biological parents.
Right.
But, if you don't have a ruling from the court, this is something that the legislature, you were mentioning, on all three of these issues, there was legislation that would deal with these issues, and they just didn't move through the legislature.
Yeah, exactly. So, on the Pardo case, Representative James Frank and Representative Stephanie Click and Senator Brian Hughes all carried legislation that would have addressed most of the issues raised in the Pardo case in particular. And, after the legislative session, we warned lawmakers. We said, hey, look, you didn't get these things passed. It's going to happen to more families. Sure enough, within a couple months, it was happening to more families.
In the news. And then, obviously, with the Younger case and the issue of these transgender, there's already legislators out there saying we need to just ban this kind of procedure on, so we shouldn't have to worry about whether these kinds of things are going to be done to children.
Yeah, and during the 2019 session, also Senator Hughes, and I believe it was Representative Dean, maybe filed a bill that said that, whether a parent or a custodian of a child affirmed or did not affirm a transgender ideology could not play into a custody decision, which was the major legal issue in this case was exactly that, is whether the fact that the father disagreed with pushing this transgender ideology on his 7-year-old son could be used as grounds to terminate his parental rights or to take away his custody.
Yeah, and so that's something that needs to be cleaned up. And then obviously with the Clay case, there was legislation and will be legislation to try and fix that problem of having a live-in boyfriend suddenly have some kind of claims.
Correct. Yeah. So actually also Senator Hughes. So he was out there on all three of these issues. Actually, he filed the bill in the Senate and Representative Jeff Leach filed the bill in the House that basically would have taken all of the constitutional rules that are right now floating around in case law and boiled them down and stuck them right into the family code. And among those things is a requirement that says, hey, anytime you're going to overrule the decision of a fit parent, you have to overcome the presumption that what they're doing is already in the best interest of their child.
Yeah, and so we want to protect those parental rights. Very important fights to be involved in. Obviously, Texas Homeschool Coalition leading the fight on this, not just for the issue of homeschooling, but for parental rights, because obviously homeschooling parents often a target of legal action that wants to limit their rights as parents. And so it's an area that you all have become experts in defending. If folks out there are having any issues involving parental rights, want to connect with your organization, want to get more involved in the fight on this legislation, how can they connect with you?
Yeah, so they can go to thsc.org. And they'll find our website there. They can also find us by the same name on Facebook. And we're sending out regular updates about the Pardo case in particular, the Clay case as it develops as well, and sharing some information about the Younger case as well.
Great. Well, go check it out. Go check out Texas Homeschool Coalition. Great resource, great people, really involved in a great fight and something I think we all need to be connected with and involved in. Thanks for the update.
All right. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's that time of year again. Empower Texans' annual Conservative Leaders Gala is right around the corner. The Conservative Leaders Gala is a time for a celebration and fellowship with members of the grassroots from the far reaches of the Lone Star State. And of course, as we've done every year, 12 awesome activists will be honored in front of the crowd and be awarded engraved cavalry swords symbolizing their role on the front lines of the fight for freedom. So, RSVP today at empowertexans.com/events and join us at the Conservative Leaders Gala December 7th in Irving, Texas.
Speaking of failed legislation, in this week's commentary, Kerry Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility gives a postmortem on what happened with the spending limits bill during the most recent legislative session.
For years, Texas Republicans have been campaigning on limiting the growth of government and providing tax relief for all Texans. But despite controlling the state for nearly a quarter century, Republican leaders have failed to pass a strong spending limit that actually protects taxpayers. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Kerry Cheshire, Vice President of Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. The past legislative session, Republicans worked with Democrats to pass a bloated budget that grows the size of government by more than 12%. That's a substantial increase beyond the growth of the state of Texas or her citizens' ability to pay. But what happened to those trying to limit the growth of state government this session? For clarity's sake, let's begin by reviewing the two existing limitations on state government. The first is the pay-as-you-go limit, which was approved by Texas voters in 1942. It requires that for every state appropriation made, there's enough money available in that particular account, preventing the state from generating budget deficits. And it's really only good for that purpose. The second is the spending limit, which was approved by Texas voters in 1978. It restrains the rate of growth in appropriations from one biennium to the next. Specifically, the amendment states, quote, "In no biennium shall the rate of growth of appropriations from state tax revenues not dedicated by this Constitution exceed the estimated rate of growth of the state's economy. The legislature shall provide by general law procedures to implement this section." This is the limit that actually impacts the state. Since that language was approved in 1978, the state's had a spending limit, but it's an ineffective one. One problem is that the spending limit only applies to non-constitutionally dedicated general revenue. In other words, only about half the budget. The second problem stems from the fact that, quote, "the estimated rate of growth of the state's economy is not explicitly defined. Instead, the power to define it is vested in the Texas legislature, a legal equivalent of allowing the foxes to guard the henhouse." And speaking of those foxes, 7 years later, in 1985, the legislature chose the ones it wanted to stand the post, the Legislative Budget Board, which is comprised of the Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker of the House, each of which appoint four additional members. At the same time, the LBB was charged with determining the estimated rate of growth of the state's economy by, quote, "dividing the estimated Texas total personal income for the next biennium by the estimated total personal income for the current biennium." However, projected personal income growth is a poor metric for limiting government spending. Instead, conservatives have argued the state should reform that definition and replace it with a combination of population and inflation and apply the limit to the entirety of the state budget. That's exactly what lawmakers have been trying to do for nearly a decade, trying and being stopped by liberal Republicans working with Democrats. Such was the case in 2015 when legislation carried by State Senator Kelly Hancock was gutted in the Texas House by then-Appropriations Chairman John Otto. A similar situation occurred in the regular session of 2017, when Hancock again passed the legislation out of the Texas Senate, only to have it die without a hearing in the House Appropriations Committee chaired by John Zerwas. In the 2017 special session, however, lawmakers were successful in getting a strong measure out of Zerwas's committee and onto the floor for a vote. Carried in the House by the chairman of the House Republican Caucus, Tan Parker, many expected the measure to pass, but it was killed on a Democrat point of order. Though Parker attempted to overrule the decision of House Speaker Joe Strauss to kill the bill, a small number of Republicans joined forces with Democrats to finally defeat it. In 2019, House Speaker Dennis Bonin promised to allow Republicans to work through the process, and many hoped the legislation would pass. They were wrong. The measure's defeat this year was much less eventful. As was the case in the regular session of 2017, State Senator Kelly Hancock was successful in passing the measure out of the Texas Senate. But again, the bill was defeated in John Zerwas's Appropriations Committee without even receiving a hearing. Texans are right to be frustrated that those who were elected on promises to limit the size and scope in government have thus far refused to keep their pledge to do so, and instead worked with Democrats to grow the size of government and kill efforts to rein in spending. They'll have an opportunity to ensure that those lawmakers do make good on their promises when they choose their new representatives this coming March and this November. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Kerry Cheshire.
Well, that's all I've got for you this week. If you've enjoyed the show, make sure you never miss a program by subscribing to the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast, available on all the podcasting platforms, iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.